to error correction codes.
Error correction in tensor network. Yes, all right. So, well, thank you for being here. Yes, so in fact, this is the wrong title. It will be, this talk will be about error correction, quantum and classical tensor networks. So I'll use the slides just for 20 minutes just to set the stage, and it's kind of easier to draw pictures and recycling old talks. And so this is an example of a code that builds on branching Mera, which you may have heard about. Otherwise, I'll present them here. So my original goal was to kind of present those in details, because there's a lot of beautiful math here and a very complex proof. But so I wanted to prepare this last night, and Frank forced me to go out and drink some beer, and he begged me to talk about the tensor network. So, I'll give a more broad overview of how we can apply tensor network methods in coding theory. Okay, so what's the background? Well, in the 40s, late 40s, Shannon derived the optimal achievable rate, C, at which information can be transmitted reliably on a noisy channel. So here was kind of the Shannon's theorem. He says there exists a family of code of size n, and n here is a parameter. You can have larger and larger code that encode k bits. So k is some fraction, some fixed fraction of n, and as you grow n, k grows as well. Okay, with a vanishing probability of error as n goes to infinity, provided that this fraction is less than the capacity. So that's the meaning of the capacity. It's the highest rate at which you can reliably send information in the channel. So the coding scheme that Shannon used to prove this was computationally inefficient in the sense that once you receive the information, you know, this proves that the information is still there. The data that was transmitted is somewhere in the received message, but it's computationally inefficient to get that data out of the message. Okay, so designing capacity achieving efficient decodable code, so codes that can, whose rate can be very, very close to the capacity, and that you can classically process efficiently, has been an open problem for half a century. And it was solved in 2009 by Arakan with the idea of polar code. So this is a family of code with a tunable rate. So like, give me a channel, I'll tune the rate of the polar code, and it will, provided that the rate is less than the capacity, it will have a probability of error that decreases kind of exponentially with the block size. And it's kind of like a exponential with the square root of the block size. So in this introduction, I want to present a new family of code that is kind of similar to this polar code. It uses IDEA for quantum information science, and the kind of improvement it get is that it gives a larger beta. Okay, beta is something like 0.7. Okay, so I will assume that you don't know anything about tensors. So just one slide introduction to tensors. So a vector is an object with one index, so you draw it as a box with one leg, and a matrix is an object with two indices, so you draw it this way. And then you can start doing manipulation. So if you want to take a multiply a matrix by a vector, you just kind of glue their legs together. And the mathematical meaning of this gluing is this sum. Okay, you're contracting indices together. And then, you know, you can start playing with these pictures. This would be the trace of a matrix, because you've identified the input with the output. And you can build more complex object, like we would say that this is a rank 4 tensor, and sometimes when we say, you know, these indices have some dimension to them, we call this the bond dimension. And most of this talk, these will always be binary variable. Once you have these more complex tensors, you can start doing all sorts of things. Okay, so the number of legs is equal to the rank, and the range is the bond dimension. Okay. So then when you have a lot of very simple small tensors, you can combine them into larger objects like this, and these are called a tensor network. In classical coding theory, they're often referred to as factor graph. So if you have an object with all the legs attached to each other. Well, this is just a scalar, right? So it's just a number, and evaluating this number can be is what we, you know, this is contracting the tensor network means evaluating this number, and in general, this is a computationally hard problem. It's sort of like computing the partition function of some classical model, which in general is a hard, computationally hard problem. It's much, yeah. However, some tensor networks are simple to contract, so a line is a good example. So how would you contract this guy? I mean, it looks like you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 indices to sum over, so it looks like maybe, you know, it would take 2 to the 6, because that's the number of terms that you need to sum. But of course, you take advantage of the distributive, law for addition and multiplication, and you say, well, I'm first going to sum over this index, and so this is going to give me a new object. And then I'm going to sum over this index, and that's going to give me a new object, and you just go on like this, and this is kind of like the transfer matrix approach. You could have a tree. A tree would also be simple because you would say, all right, let me sum these two indices, and that will give me a new tensor, and you can repeat this and then just iterate, okay? So in general, the complexity of contracting a tensor network scales exponentially with the tree width of the corresponding graph. So if you don't know what the tree width is, you can think of kind of coarse graining some of these, you could say, you know, like I'll just treat those as one big tensor. It's some kind of coarse graining, and it's like how much do you need to coarse grain before the thing looks like a tree? Okay, that's roughly what the tree width is. Okay, so this was tensor network. Now, how does it relate to coding? Well, you can write down, okay, so we're interested in bit strings here. So you can represent a probability distribution over n bits as a rank n tensor. So, I mean, you know, these are all binary variables. So this is essentially just a collection of 2 to the n numbers. And these 2 to the n numbers are the probability of the 2 to the n different bit strings, okay? So these are not necessarily, I mean, an example of this would be like an IID probability distribution where, I mean, when there's no contraction, it just means you literally take the product of these things, right? So this is an IID probability distribution. It means maybe like that each bit is in the state 0 with probability 1 minus p, and it's in the state 1 with probability p. Okay. So once you have this representation, you can represent more objects using this tensor network. So what is this thing here? This is the probability distribution on, n minus 1 bit, given that the first one is 0. Okay. So you can think of this as some kind of conditional probability. And now I'm using, so what are these tensors? I mean, so these are just vectors. And this one is kind of the projection on the zero state, and this one is the projection on the one state. Okay, so this is how you would write a conditional probability. The other thing, so conditioning is one important kind of primitive that we want to do. Another important primitive is taking marginals. So let's say that I don't care about this bit. I want the marginal distribution over these n minus 1 bits. So essentially, I want to sum over the possible values of the first bit. Well, I just need to contract with this tensor, which is, you know, like the flat distribution, okay? So now we have the ability to take marginal and to take conditional probabilities. Okay, so before I explain to you how this is used in coding theory, I need to say a little bit more about coding theory. So I'm going to talk a lot about classical codes just for simplicity. A lot of this stuff applies to quantum codes. And when there's kind of an important difference, I'll mention it. Okay, so let's look at classical linear codes. So these are specified by a k by n generator matrix. So this is a code which encodes k bit into n bit. So n is larger, and k over n is the rate. So you have a binary matrix G, and here's how this is done. So let's represent the element of Z2 by these small vectors. So this is 0, this is 1. Then the generator matrix can be represented this way. So here are your K input bits, and here are your N output bits. And this is just a matrix telling you like how your data should be encoded. So it's a linear matrix over GF2. Right. Okay, so you know it looks like a tensor. Its rank is k plus n. But I'm going to increase this. So I like to think of this encoding matrix, which is of course not reversible because I mean it's k by n. It's a rectangular matrix. I like to think embedded in an invertible matrix zero just by padding. So if you want, this is some kind of an isometry. And I can view this isometry as a unitary by embedding it into a larger space. So I'm just going to pad this thing with zero. But now E, you can read it from top to bottom or bottom to top. Okay, top to bottom would be, this is how you encode. And I'll tell you about what bottom to top means in a few slides. Well, now, so here it is. Yep.
You understand right that these are permutation matrices?
Are they permutation matrices? No. They are linear in the sense that if you take an input and you compute the output, and then you take a different input and you compute the output, then the sum of the, if you were...
But the permutation matrix is linear, no? But if you're not like...
No. Not linear. It's linear. I mean, these are n by k matrices, and there are 2 to the n bit strings, right? So permutation over the group of 2 to the n elements requires a very large matrix. These are linear over Z2, right? So if I give you 2 bit string and you know how they get encoded, if I consider the bit string that's the sum of those, it gets encoded as the sum.
Sorry, I mean the permutation between the k qubits, the k bits.
No, I guess it's permutation in these 2 to the n dimensional.
It does implement, but it's a very special one. It's one that's...
It's a special permutation matrix.
That's a permutation.
Yeah.
A simple one.
It's a simple one, but I mean, I think if viewing it this way won't buy you anything, right? Because you're dealing with exponentially large matrices. So I think linear codes, I mean, and that's the problem with nonlinear code is that typically you don't have a means for representing them efficiently. These are very simple. Yeah. You can view them as permutation over 2 to the n elements, but I think that the linearity is very important. Yeah. So I'm going to view this encoder or generator matrix as an invertible matrix that I've padded with zeros. But now, let's suppose that, I take this, I encode my data, I send it down a channel, and I receive this bit string here, okay? Well, now I can run it backwards, and I should get zeros here, and the data that I had encoded over here. However, typically what will happen is that here, I will not see all zeros, and the job, the task of decoding is to say, okay, I've seen here what we call an error syndrome, which is typically not all zeros. I want to figure out what has occurred here. Okay, that's the decoding problem. It's a hard problem in general. It's also like NP-complete, this one. But if this guy has structure, then you can solve the problem. Okay? So here's the kind of problem that we are interested in. So we have a probability distribution. There's something I should say before I show this slide. This is maybe a little bit confusing. So we have this E. So we have a bit string X. And we put with, can everyone see this?
It's pretty dark. There's a light.
Oh, there's a light, yeah. Oh, then I'm gone. You have a bit string, X, and you put some zeros, and you encode it. And that gives you Y. Okay? Now, Y goes to Y plus an error that we can call Y prime. Okay, so this means that some of the bits of Y have been flipped, so you can just view this as adding a vector of error. Now what I want to do is do E minus 1 of y prime. But this is, of course, e minus 1 of y plus e minus 1 of e. Okay? This here, by definition, will produce x and 0, sorry, okay, because it's just the inverse of this. And this one here will be responsible for creating a syndrome and some kind of logical error. And my goal is to know x, but what I know is the sum of these two things. So I can phrase the decoding problem as saying, I know S and I want to learn what L is. Okay? So I know the syndrome and I want to infer what's the logical error. So that's how I'm going to view this. Okay? So I know the syndrome and I want to infer what was the error. So here's the logical error. So here's the probability distribution over the syndrome. So over the error. So that's the probability distribution of this E here. Okay? I've drawn it as a general thing, but typically it will be an IID noise model or something like this. Okay, now, so this is really representing this equation. I have E, which has some probability distribution. I invert E, so I get the syndrome here. And my goal is to figure out what was the logical. And here's the probability distribution for that logical. So this tensor network encodes the probability that we want to compute. Okay, it's the probability of a logical error given a syndrome.
But for conditional probabilities, don't we need to divide also?
Yeah, but I mean, yes, that's correct. I kind of slipped that under the rug earlier on. I said it's a conditional probability. Of course, you would need to divide by the probability of the thing you're conditioning on. Here, we're interested in maximizing. And they all have the same denominator. It's the probability of that syndrome. So you don't care about that. Yeah. So I should say, yeah, most of the things I say are only true up to some constant that are not important. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Did you make some assumption here that somehow the channel that created the errors was linear?
I assumed that it was symmetric, indeed. So the probability that it affects a 0 is the same as the probability that it affects a 1. Absolutely. And this may or may not be true.
But what are the conditions of the error channel?
Here, okay. So for this talk for the entire talk, I will assume that every bit gets flipped with some probability p.
Okay, so you have a model, and they're not correlated, uncorrelated. All of these kind of
things. Well, I will get into correlated as well. So here, I didn't say what this thing was. You can imagine if I just put a bunch of separate boxes here, this will be an uncorrelated noise model. If I put an NPS, this will be a correlated noise model. If I put a MERA, it will be some kind of... So yeah, that's something that, like, if you know about tensor network, you can start playing with this, which is something that people in coding theory don't really do. But of course, you know, in reality, the errors are correlated. You know, like a scratch on a CD, if one bit is flipped, the next one is very likely to be flipped. Right, and they have some model for this, and if you read the model, it's a pass. There's still a problem with this because now we would want to compute this and then optimize over x, but x is a large bit string, right? It has k bits, so this object lives in a space. You know, it's this thing is just a representation of 2 to the k numbers, so you can't optimize over these 2 to the k number because it's just too big of a problem. So one thing that you will do, I mean, for this type, so there are many, many tricks when you start doing this. One of them would be to just look at these guys marginally, to sum over everyone and just look like marginally what's the probability of this bit. And I'll talk about this a bit later. For this particular code that I want to present here, we will do sequential decoding. So let's assume that some of the bits are known because, like, you've decided what they were earlier on. So these are already known. So let's fix their value. So we're kind of conditioning on knowledge of those. And the other guys we don't know. So we will kind of take the marginal over these guys. So now we're left with a probability over a single bit. And that's just, you know, two numbers. And we can optimize over that. And it will, as it will happen, I mean, it will also be necessary to pretend that some of the syndrome bits are not known, so I will put some E's here. I think this will become clear later. So these are the type of objects. So we will decode the bits one by one, and once we make a decision on that bit, we assume that it's true and we move on. Okay? And you might say, but what if you made a mistake? You know, what if these bits that you decoded were wrong? Well, if they're wrong and now we're conditioning on them, you might think, oh, you're just doing something catastrophic. But if they're wrong, we don't care. We've lost the game already, right? So may as well assume that we were right and just move on. So the goal here is to get the right answer. So as soon as we do a mistake, it doesn't matter what we do. Okay.
It's consistent with the Shan statement about the error correction.
Yep. Despite this, it will be exponentially. Yeah. So every choice has to be right.
Sorry, sir.
Yes.
Confirm. Are you trying to optimize E? Is that the task?
Sorry, E. Remember. Okay. So this is. E is the flat distribution, right? 1-1. X represent like it's a, you know, it's either 1-0 or 0-1. It represents the bit. So now, okay, so this is a probability distribution. So it's just two numbers, and then you pick the biggest one. Okay, I mean, if it's 90%, 10%, you say, all right, it was probably a 0, and for the next iteration, you will assume that this is a 0. Okay, but ideally, it won't be 90%. 1%, it will be like 99.999999% and the rest. It should be very, very strongly polarized. Okay. And I mean, the probability of an error is the sum of these deviation from 1, right? No, I said the probability of an error is the sum of the remaining part. So it's like, it's the remaining, you know, this 0.001% is the probability that you made the wrong decision. So then you have to add the probability that I made the wrong decision the first time, the probability that I made the wrong decision the second time, and so on. So the sum of those needs to be exponentially small. Make sense? If you take the product of being right, you get roughly the same answer, right? Okay, so this was all very generic. Let me tell you what are polar codes. So polar codes are this tensor network. So, there's always two ways to draw things. Either you have gates that are kind of long range, or you cross the wires. And Giffrey and Glenn cross the wires, and I draw long range gates. Okay. So if you don't, this is a branching tree in their language. So here, let's just put a memory-less channel here, so an IID type of channel, no correlation, just for the sake of it. And let's suppose that, so this will be important here, we will decode from right to left. So at some point, we know all these bits, we have no idea of those, and we want to decode this one. Okay? So this is the tensor network that we need to evaluate. But you can check that it doesn't have a constant tree width. Okay, so this is not something you can evaluate directly. So we will use a few circuit identity. One of them is if you apply a C naught onto a random bit, I mean you just get a random bit again. Okay, so a random bit goes through a C naught. If you have a zero that's controlling the C naught, of course nothing happens. And if you have a 1 controlling a C naught, you just apply a naught. So these are, most of the things that we do with tensor network are purely like graphical. These are not, I mean, these are algebraic relations. So if once we use these algebraic relations, we can eliminate all of those gates. So in fact, the circuit has n log n gates, and now it has only n gates. So you've eliminated almost every gate. And now this thing is a tree. So why is it a tree? Because look, I can say, okay, let me take these, you know, this is an object. I can just replace it by a tensor by summing over, you know, this line, this line, this line, and this line. So that will just give me an object. I can repeat this, and so on. Okay, so this is a tree.
Can I ask? Yeah. So I don't know anything about the polar code. So why did you start with that picture before? As in,
why this graph?
Like before.
Why this?
Yeah, so we, at the first we coupled, the next ones were...
No, so I mean, I mean, there was a history of why this one was chosen. It had nothing to do with tensor network. I mean, no one ever draws this circuit in the coding community. They have a very different way of thinking about it. But if you analyze what they've done, it's this. So I didn't choose this. It turns out it's a very good choice.
So is this like a Mera?
Not yet.
Modified
version? No. Yeah, it's a Mera where you've removed all the disentanglers. Sorry, a branching Mera, where you've removed all the disentanglers. So it's a branching tree.
You should have said branching tree only after we apply.
Well, I use a branching tree in a... so I'll get to maybe this terminology a little bit later.
What should we see in this picture?
Well, you should understand why if someone has chosen this circuit and this is what they want to decode with, forget about their motivation, let's suppose, then you understand why it can be done. Okay? My first idea was to kind of prove why these things are capacity achieving, but yeah, so I decided instead to give a kind of a more broad talk, but I could talk about this some other time.
It's very classical so far.
It's very classical, yeah.
And so the last replacements on the bottom are...
So, you know, I mean, why is all of this... If you go to the quantum case, okay, almost everything is identical. The reason is because you will assume that these are Pauli matrices. So instead of having a property for 0 and 1, you will have a property for identity x, y, z. But I mean, these identity are true, like, you know, an x matrix propagates in a very nice way through a control knot, like an x acting on the target just goes straight true because, and so on. So this picture remains true almost everything I say. So, yeah, and I think, you know, you get the idea from the classical picture. So there was this idea of of the Mera that is this circuit here. The motivation was kind of there, and this is a branching Mera. A Mera at every stage you eliminate half of the bits, right? You disentangle, and then you apply an isometry where, like, all the even bits just are now in a product state, so you just eliminate them. Okay. In a branching Mera, you kind of do the same thing, but instead of eliminating half of the bits, you send all the even bits to the left and all the odd bits to the right. And then you apply the same procedure again to each half separately. Okay, so this is a branching Mera. And the tensor network here are efficiently contractible. You can notice that the... as I said, you know, these guys cross wires and we have long range gates, but like if you kind of fold the graph that we had, you would find that it's exactly this one, except that the green gates are all trivial. All the green gates would be identity. So our idea was to say, let's put them back and see what happens, okay? So this was kind of the primitive for the polar code. Now we'll be using this primitive, okay? Just in pictures, so this was a polar code, and this is a branching, or we now call them convolutional polar codes, or if you want, a branching Mera code, but that's not a very catchy name in the coding community. So you've just, like, it used to be only the black gates, and now you've added these blue gates, okay, which are like the disentanglers. You can put periodic boundary conditions or open boundary conditions. We've looked at both, and it doesn't make a big difference. It's important to know, however, that the decoding process breaks this translational invariance because you have to start decoding at a place. Okay. So when you pick this place, you break the translational invariance. So in this sense, whether you put or not boundary, periodic boundary doesn't really affect the performance.
Why you want to change the particles? It's already good enough, right?
Why not? Because so you could ask, like, you know, why don't we use this? My cell phone does not have a polar code, okay? But it's the best. Why don't we use it? Because this error exponent is too small, okay? So they are very good, but asymptotically. So these have a better error exponent, and they're becoming very interesting for applications. But you know, this sounds very sophisticated, but I had no idea. I just said, let's do it and numerically check. And we saw that they were better. Okay. So again, so once you do the gate identities, you know, a lot of these gates get removed. So it doesn't show so much in this picture, but again, you went from n log n to n. You have
So why did you take this particular choice for this entanglement?
It's just the first one we tried.
Okay, but you could try many other ones.
Yes. We now have like a factory of these things now. Yeah. And you can put Toffoli and whatnot. And Toffoli is interesting because it's nonlinear. Yeah. But you can still do it. And people, like, if you tell this to people in coding theory, they say, no. Nonlinear code cannot be decoded. Yes? It's just a tensor network. Okay. So now you believe me that, you know, we have this generalization. I have a classical efficient decoder for this. So now let me just show you what we do in numerical experiments. Okay, so something that you may ask yourself, because we went from an invertible matrix that had some zero and some data. So you could say, where are the zero and where are the data here? Okay. So this is a choice you need to make. You need to decide where you're going to put the zeros and where you're going to put the data. So for this, you do a dry run. You just kind of evaluate these tensor network for every position, and you get these kind of plot. Okay, so let me see. I think so up here it means that sort of, you know, when you compute the probability of your first bit, you have no information, so it will give you just like 50-50, and that's what's here. And then, okay, you say, but now I know this first bit, I move to the next bit. You have just one bit of information, you go to the second bit, and it's all, again, 50-50. But then eventually, the bits become what we call polarized. And the last bit is very, very polarized, like in the sense that when you decode it, you know exactly what the value should be. Is that clear what this... So this is a graph representing polarization. So essentially, it represents these tensor network where you put a bunch of zero here, an open one, a bunch of E, and you just evaluate it. Okay? And it sort of tells you how reliable that position is given all the previous position. So what you do is you do this dry run, and then you take the ones that are very, very low here. Okay? You take these locations and you say, this is where I'm going to put my data, because these positions are very strongly polarized. And the ones, the positions that are not polarized, I'm going to put zeros at these locations. Okay? So you plot this thing, and you can sort of set your error tolerance. You say, everything that is below, you know, 10 to the minus 6, I will keep. Everything that's above 10 to the minus 6, I will not put data there. And that will give you your code. Yes?
So would this make sorting of the qubits or of the bits make this plot more fun?
Yeah. So this is the plot. So these were, okay, so these were obtained for polar code. This is for branch, the branching mirror. And if you sort them, you see a little difference, but it gets more interesting later. So this is just a dry run. So in fact, you always want to look at these things on, like, the interesting stuff is here, okay? So you don't really see it, but it's on a log scale, you do see. So essentially, you know, let's suppose that your threshold was 10 to the minus 6. Well, I mean, you go from encoding, I don't know, like 200 bit to like 260 bits. Okay, this was a code length of, it's this code length here. So so you kind of increase your rate from, maybe 200 to 260. So you get to send more data with the same threshold using these polar code. Okay? Or if you want to put it another way, let's say that you use a rate 1/4 encoding. Well, your error would drop from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 10 or something like this. Okay? So this is the kind of improvement that you get by going to these branching structures. By adding disentanglers. So it's a very, very big improvement in some sense, like several orders of magnitude for a given rate. Okay. So I think this is all I wanted to say with these slides. So now I am going to switch to the board and talk more broadly about the use of tensor network in other codes. So this was like one specific example of how Well, I mean, I wanted to do two things with these slides. First, give a very concrete, specific example, but also set the stage, okay? So now you understand the decoding problem, you understand how it can be represented by a tensor network, and you understand that sometimes we have to play trick, like this sequential decoding was an approximation, right? I mean, ideally you wanted to find just the optimal bit string over all the 2 to the k, but you optimize bit by bit. And I should say that the proof that these things are efficient is kind of despite this suboptimal decoder, okay?
Why are they called polar?
Oh yeah, so the idea is that they were invented in Canada. No, that's right. So they view this thing, yeah. They view this thing like every time you do a C0, this is their way of thinking. Every time you do a C0, one of the bit gets copied to the other bit, and the other bit gets like, you know, written over, right? So one of them becomes better because you spread the information. One of them becomes worse. So this is a polarization procedure, where you take 2 equal bit and you create a better one and a worse one. And you can think of the graph as just, okay, you do this, and then you take all your better ones, you put them together, and you take all your worse ones, you put them together, and you just iterate the procedure. And this is why it gives you like this branching type of structure. Okay, so this is the way they think
so
about
polar,
it.
Like in polarization.
Polarization, yes. And I should say the proof that these things work, you view it as a random walk through this polarization world. So sometimes you go to the left, sometimes you go to the right, and you can show that on average how many times will you step to the left, and this gives you like the probability of error. So it's a very beautiful, so it shows that like the probability that you do the right number of steps to the left is high enough so this thing polarizes.
And you have an intuition why it doesn't find itself?
Yes, we do. It's sort of at the same level. So now there are kind of 4 type of steps, and you know, some of, I mean, it mathematically you see, and it gives us an intuition also for how to build codes that are even better. But yeah, you have to go, I mean, once you read the proof, you say, oh yes, this is where I need to improve things. So it's about having stronger polarization at every step.
So is there an upper bound on the error rate?
Oh, a 1, yeah. So remember, what's this thing, right? So it's that we get a probability of error that's 2 to the minus n to some power beta, right?
And the beta is
beta is equal 1/2, and I think we get log 3 over 2. That is r. And we kind of see how to improve this, okay?
And what are the best codes, the non-polar codes? What is the best error rate of non-polar codes?
It depends if you mean empirical or...
Empirical.
These would be LDPC codes that I will talk about a little bit later. I don't know what these things are. But also, like, we see a difference between numerics and this value, okay? So we see better numerics than this. We don't... I mean, I think that these polar codes are interesting from... Are these generalization are interesting from both point of view. One, because we can prove stuff about them, and they're also good empirically. Okay. But so I believe that kind of the theoretical limit is 1 on beta, but I don't know what has been done. And I should also say that it's the corrections that people in the applied community care about, because this will be subleading term that asymptotically go away, but we're interested in fairly small code, and you could say why we keep sending gigabytes of data, but there was a decision made like 30 years ago that the block size would be like 1,600 bits, and you can't change that. So there are kind of communication standards that are really hard to. You could say, no, use these guys, but go to block size of 1 million or something. It's going to be much better. But this is not how this community wants to. They don't want to hear that. So it's been unfortunate. Okay. Let me talk about another. Was there another question? No? Okay. Another type of code. So I think that the setting is clear, right? So these will all be linear codes. So we have this stuff that I wrote there. our goal, so this is a machinery that takes a probability on E, which is just your model for the channel, and it outputs a probability of L given the syndrome. And this is the sort of thing we want to evaluate, and this, the tensor network is a way of encoding this probability. But typically, we will be either interested in the marginal of this, so this is the global. We will sometimes be interested in marginal, which would be like P of the ith bit given the syndrome. And sometimes we will do this sequential, where we will probability of the ith bit given the syndrome and logical I minus 1 to logical 1, right? So these are the kind of tricks that we will be playing. Yes?
Sorry, going back a bit. But you mentioned this dry run in which you
calculate
these conditional probabilities.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that you're, like, for the first one, you're assuming that all the others are random.
Yep.
For the second one, you're assuming that all are random except one.
Okay. I didn't want to go into those details, but here I was modeling an erasure channel. So 0 means the bit was not erased. 1 means it's erased. So when I do the dry run, I always put 0 on the left, which means assuming that no bits has been erased yet, what's the probability that this one is erased? So I'm computing the probability that the bit is the first to be erased. That's what I'm computing. So it's a bit tricky, and there are other ways of choosing these positions.
It's a different noise model.
Yeah. Just for simplicity, because the other one I can't present with the tensor network. There's another trick you can do, which takes into account the model. But with this picture, this is the best one too.
Actually, why do you call this a tensor network and not a quantum circuit?
Because it's classical. And like, ultimately, it's about contracting a tensor. That's the important thing here. I don't care that these objects represent transformation or anything. It's just what matters is that I contract some tensor. Okay, so yeah, I want to continue to convince you that this is a useful idea. So I will talk about convolutional code. So I will just represent, again, every time I will describe a code, or most of the time, I will represent it, I will just show you what's the circuit for E. So for a convolutional code, the circuit looks like this. Okay, so now time goes like this, these are just some gates. You can put whatever you want in them. If it's classical, you put some classical gate. If it's quantum, you put some quantum gate. And maybe like the number of wires, of course, is a parameter. You can change them. And here maybe you would put like 0 on all these wires, so these will become your syndrome bit, and you would put data here, on that bit, data here. So clearly this would be a rate 1/2, because half of the wires carry data, the other half carries, it's just redundancy. Okay, so it turns out, so clearly this is an MPS, and the bond here, we call this memory. Like here there are 2 bits of memory, and this is like the log of the bond dimension, okay? So there are actually 2 type of things that you can do here. You can do marginal decoding. Which means computing the probability of Li. Li would be like one of these position, given the syndrome. And this is done, this is a transfer matrix. And I think I can convince you that this can be done very easily. What you would do is, like, on each of these, you would put your noise model. So you would cap these off
with some noise model P. Here you would put whatever bit that you saw, right? On these are no longer zero usually, so you would put the syndrome bit here. You know, syndrome, you would put a syndrome bit here, and so on. And let's say that I want to compute this guy here. Well, I would just cap all the other wires, all the data wire, with this guy here, with like this uniform distribution. And then just this gives me like a 1D tensor network, and I just do the transfer matrix. Is that clear enough, high level enough, or yeah, it's believable. It turns out that using this, you can compute two type of object. You can say, what's the property of L? Or you can say, given the syndrome that I saw, what's the updated probability for this guy? You can kind of choose to compute the probability of the data or to update your noise model, so to speak. Given the syndrome that I saw, what's the probability that this bit has been flipped? Okay, so since I've been calling the error E, I have a two meaning for E. Sorry. Anyway, I'll just use capital E. You can also compute the probability. Okay, so just to be clear, these guys live on this side. This guy lives on this side. Okay, so you're just kind of updating your error model, and that will be important. It turns out that you can also do global. So this may sound surprising, because what I'm saying here, you know, you have this thing is repeated a very long time, so you have now an exponentially large probability, and you can find in that space the optimal probability. And if you think about it for a second, this is just dynamical programming. And so maybe you're a bit less familiar with this, so let me just give you an intuition of how this works. So you draw a trellis. So this is kind of a graph that has some kind of a linear structure. So these guys, okay, so these four dots represent the four memory states, okay? So this would be 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. Okay, and I had two bits of memory, so there are four states here. And at some location, I have a syndrome. Okay, so I have a syndrome here. So what I can say is, okay, let's say I know what memory state I was in here. Okay, so I know this memory state. I want to know what memory state can I reach here, and with what probability. So first of all, I have this hard data. I know what the syndrome is, and I just have to put all the possible errors. So like, let's say I start in these two wires in the state 0, 1, and then I can put 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, and I say where each of those will lead me. What's the next memory state that will lead me? And there's also a probability of the error. Okay, so if I put a certain error E in those wires, it will take me to a new memory state, and I just put that probability here. Now, that probability should be zero if it leads me to that memory state here but produces the wrong syndrome. So I have to check that it produces the right syndrome and it takes me to this other memory state. And the other thing that I know is what logical would it put here? If I put an error here with a memory, what logical would it produce? So I can put that logical as an extra bit of information. And now, finding the highest weight error pattern consistent with the syndrome is just finding the shortest path to traverse this graph, okay, from left to right. And I think it's kind of easy to see how it can be done, because you say, all right, you know, you would have many things, and every path sort of compute what was its cost up until here. So you have two paths arriving here. Which one has cost the less so far? So if it's this one, you just erase this edge, and you say, any path that go through this node, this one is the fastest, right? This one is the shortest. And you just go on like this, and at the end, you just have one path. Okay. So it's just finding a one path through a 1D structure. Okay, so is that clear? These are convolutional code. They're used a lot in telecom and in deep space communication as well. So now the next thing I want to talk about is turbocode.
sorry, there's an obvious way of doing this also for quantum.
Yep.
Qubits.
Yep.
Does this work?
Yep. Yep. Well, there are issues with quantum turbo codes. There are
convolutional.
Everything works well. Oh, maybe I wanted to say a few more things. No. Okay. I'll get back to them later. I mean, these things you can prove, for instance, that they have a crappy minimum distance. Yeah, it's just because of translational invariance. The way this works, like, let's say you identify one error pattern, eventually it will be periodic. So then you take this error pattern plus the same error pattern shifted, and the periodicity will cancel. Okay, but this is a small detail. Okay, so turbo codes are fun. So this was all MPS. So this is MPS plus mean field. So how, and this was a big revolution in coding theory. How does this work? So I'm going to stop drawing this complicated graph. I'm just, okay, so we have a convolutional code. I'll put a 1. And, you know, it takes as input some data and some zeros. Okay, so these are thick wires, like they carry a lot of bits. And it produces encoded data. Now what you're going to do, you're going to take this and convolutional code 2 with new zeros. You're going to send them through. So now this encoded data becomes the data of the second code, and it will produce sort of doubly encoded data.
And did you twist the wires in doing this, or
yeah,
they're still the same locality?
Yeah, and that's, yeah. So this was sort of the punchline. You put a random permutation here. Okay? So that was the key thing. All right, so why the permutation? Okay.
Permutation of the bits.
You just randomly permute the order of the bits before you re-encode them. Okay?
Well, not randomly, but random.
Random but known.
Exactly.
Yeah. It should be the same. Indeed, it's picked at random. You test it, and yeah. But okay, the randomness is very useful when you analyze these models, because you do an ensemble average. Okay, and things become much, much simpler. Of course, in reality, you pick one, but you analyze them just, and you can show some concentration, like all the permutations are good. Okay, so why this permutation? Because like, let's think about this backwards, right? So this is the stuff you're going to transmit on the channel. It's the doubly encoded data. So let's suppose that on this, you have just one small error, okay, on the data. So now you're going to send this, like, in your convolutional code number 2, so this one. And just by the structure, it's pretty clear that this will produce some kind of long error burst, right? So this will be kind of the response of this code to this large error burst. So now if you send this large error burst through another convolutional code, as I said, these things have like small minimum distance. There are always some pattern in a fixed region of space that are some logical error. Okay, so this kind of burst error is really catastrophic for convolutional code. It's so like if you were to take this directly and put it in the second convolutional code, you would, or the first one, it would almost, you know, lead to a logical error. So what you do is you apply this random permutation. So now it just looks like a IID noise model. That's really just the intuition. Okay, you remove correlation by randomness. So how does the decoding of this beast work? Why do they call them turbo? Okay, so
why do you say this MPS plus mean field?
Yeah, I'll get to that. Yeah. But I think you can already see maybe where this is going. So I wish I knew about turbo engine, but my understanding is that you use some of the output to pump something in the input, right? Can anyone explain this? Let's just, so we're all on board, right? We know what a turbo engine is. It uses some of the exhaust to pump something and improve something. So this is what these codes will do. Okay, so let's see. So again, it's the same picture, right? So you start with, maybe this is going to take a lot of space. So, well, okay, you start with your probability of error on the physical channel, and you send this through your convolutional code too. And this guy takes input also a syndrome, sorry, the second syndrome, the syndrome of the second convolutional code, and it produces a probability of the logical given the syndrome. Okay, so now I'm kind of here. Now you're gonna permute this. Okay, so you can send this through a permutation, and it's, oh sorry, no sorry. This one is going to do a marginal decoding, so it's going to compute the probability bitwise. Okay, of the so you could say, look, this logical thing is highly correlated, so assuming that decoding bitwise is a really bad idea. But this is where, you know, you invoke the permutation and you say after the permutation, it's an IID noise model. Okay, so you only keep the marginal information, you don't keep any of the global information. So then what you do is you send this stuff through your other convolutional code. And this one also has its syndrome. And then you would think that you do the same thing, probability of logical I given the syndrome, syndrome 1 and syndrome 2. But that's actually not what you do. You compute the probability of physical error. You kind of update your noise model. That, right? This, I said that you could do two things here. You could compute the probability of the data, or you could update your noise model. In this case, you're going to update your noise model and condition on the syndromes, and you're going to feed this back in the second code. So now the second code, you start the process over, but it has additional information, and you just iterate this. So this is really like, you know, we're talking to each other. I hear there'll be a barbecue this week. Did you hear about this? And you say, yes, I heard there will be a barbecue this week. You just told me, this is confirming my knowledge. And we just go back and forth. And eventually, like, yeah, there will be a barbecue. There's just no doubt about this, right? So this is what's going on. Yeah. I heard that Norbert will organize it. It's very similar. I mean, very, very similar ideas.
This is the turbo step,
right? You kind of re-inject the thing that came, that was your waste, and you just iterate this. And it's kind of really black magic, but this works. Yeah.
And if the noise is IID, it gives you nothing.
If the noise... What's the question? If the noise is...
So if the noise doesn't come in bursts, it gives you nothing.
No, you're really ignoring these bursts. So,
but does it include you still if there are no...
Sorry. Ah, this is the real noise. After you send it backward through the first convolutional code, then it produces burst. So the burst... the second code sees burst noise because it was like, you know, IID noise that went through a circuit like this. So it's not surprising, like, if you flip a bit here, it will just propagate, right? So the burst, that's where it comes from. The noise ID initially was IID.
So why does this converter create this loop?
No idea. I mean, there. So people have, okay. So you can sort of, indeed, there are some relation to belief propagation, so, which I wanted to talk about later.
Yeah. The belief propagation, you would use the original error model as well.
No, it's kind of the same as this. So this is a technique that I will describe later if I have time. I have plenty of time. And it's something that we understand. I'll talk about it later. And it sort of converges on trees. And you can argue that the loops in here are very large for very long chains. Okay. So, I mean, you can do this sort of analysis. But, yeah. Yeah. There are proofs that these things work when you average over the permutation. So for a fixed permutation, we don't know. Okay, so, I mean, physically, what's the way to think about this? The point is that, you know, we're only keeping track of marginal information, so like single bit stuff. So if you want to think about this, also this was the decoding, it's really like you have two spin chains. Spin chain one, spin chain two. And so they're, you know, they have nearest neighbor coupling, so this is all nice. But in addition, you have these sort of random, non-linear but sparse coupling between the two chains. Okay. So how would you solve such a model? Well, I mean, the idea is that you do, you do transfer matrix on this one, transfer matrix on this one, ignoring the correlations. And you use that transfer matrix result that gives you like what's the polarization of each bit as a mean field for treating those. So right, once you've computed the polarization of each bit here, you can treat this coupling as a mean field, and then you run a new tensor transfer matrix here with these mean field added, and you just go back and forth. So that's really what's going on in these turbo decoding. I think that's the right way to think about them.
Essentially, this random permutation is what's allowing you to do the mean field.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea is that it's this non-local coupling and so on. It's not exactly like infinite dimensional, but because, I mean, it's still sparse, right? I mean, it still just couples a few bit to a few bits.
Because actually you have a specific permutation.
That's correct, yeah.
But the cost of contracting that tensor network would be exponential, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you do this mean field thing between the two, then it's all right. And it gives you something decent. Okay. So is that good? Yeah, so you do this, and this you do by mean field. Okay. So, all right. So, yeah, I want to talk about another class of code, which... Yes?
By doing this, the point is that this is better than the one previously.
If you just did this... Yeah, these are pretty bad on their own. And this, like, heuristically, these are extremely good. And they're used everywhere. This, on its own... okay, what I was trying to explain before is that... the worst type of error is an error that when you push it through the circuit, it produces some stuff on the data, but nothing on the syndrome. That's really bad because you can't see that error. Another way to think about it is, let me just put a 1 on the data and push it through and see what happens, okay? So if you put a 1 on the data, it will probably produce an infinite string, but this string will be periodic. What will be the periodicity? It's the size of the bond image. So it's exponential with the memory, but it has to be periodic. It's kind of a finite state machine, right? So if it's periodic, it means that if I put a 1 here and I put another 1 later, I will kill it. So this shows you the following thing, that there are bit strings of finite length that if I push them through, it will flip some bits but leave no syndrome. So this is the proof that these things are bad, okay? And the idea, so this kind of burst error would be very bad. And the idea of the permutation is kind of to get rid of this. That's the intuition. Okay, more questions before I race? Okay, so now I want to do LDPC. LDPC were invented in the late 50s or 60s, but they were kind of forgotten for decades because the kind of computation they involved was too much at the time. You know, it was not conceivable to do this calculation very fast, but now, I mean, they are used everywhere. So LDPC, which low density parity check. And this is mean field. And it's funny, I mean, these, for this type of code, there is literally just what these guys have been doing, you know, it's just developing statistical mechanics in parallel. They give different names to everything, but they're doing exactly the same thing that people that study like spin glass physics and so on. I mean, it's just exactly the same thing. And it's fun because they also have more, sometimes more advanced techniques than the ones that were discovered in physics. Okay, so the way you represent a LDPC code is with an object that we call Tanner graph. So I'm gonna draw one here. So these little boxes represent checks, and these circles represent bits. And the fact that it's low density parity check means that these guys are sparsely connected. Okay? So sometimes you want to call those sparse codes. So you just draw random edges with the condition that the degree of every bit is low. So this is a bad example. Everyone should have a couple of lines, right? But anyway, the idea is that the degree down here is low and the degree up here is low as well. And you can easily relate the ratio of the degrees are related to the rate of the code, okay? Okay, and what's the idea? The idea is that the sum of the bits that are connected to a check must be zero, mod 2. Okay, so these are parity constraint. The sum of this bit plus this bit plus this bit plus this bit must be even. Okay, that's the constraint. So you can easily check here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9, 10, 11. So I have 2 to the 11 bit string, but each of these cut the number of bit string by half. So here I would have 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so this is 2 to the 7. So this is a code that encodes 7 bits. Okay, so you just take the number of bits, you subtract the number of checks, and that tells you how many bits are encoded, provided that these are linearly independent, right? That one is not the sum of two other. Okay. So how do we decode those? So those, yeah. I mean, they have a finite rate and everything. It's nice. So now you have some probabilities down here. P of E1, P of E2. Okay, or maybe they're all the same. It doesn't matter. And the decoding algorithm is what we call belief propagation. And it will sort of go back and forth between the bits and the checks. Okay? And here are the rules. So they will exchange messages. So the bits will send a message here. The checks will send a message back and forth. Here are the rules for these messages. So let's say that a bit is connected to a check is connected to 4 bits, and it receives messages from each of these bits, and then it has to send a message to all the other bits. So the message that it will send to this bit is a function of the message that it receives from the other bits. And if you think about it for like half a second, and of course of the observed syndrome. So the first thing you do is you measure these parity, and you know which one were violated and which one were not violated. Okay. So here, let's say, from each one of them, you receive P2, P3. These are the probability that this bit got flipped, this bit got flipped, this bit got flipped. Okay. So initially, these would just be those prior. You just say, here's the probability that I was flipped. And okay. Here you have to say, you know the total parity, you know the probability that each one got flipped, what's the probability that this one got flipped? I mean, it's very easy to compute, right? I mean, it's kind of
the output is the total parity of the input?
S here takes value 0 or 1, and it gives you the parity of all four. So you know the parity of all four, you know the marginal probability of each one of those, so you can easily say what's the property that this one got flipped. I mean, I don't know if I need to write a formula for this, but it will be like product over all I, sum over all bit string, probability 1 x1, probability 2 x2, probability 3 x3. So these are these incoming. And you sum over all the x such that, you know, x is even or odd depending on the syndrome, right? So is that clear what you would do? I mean, it's just kind of Bayesian calculus applied to a known. So that tells you the check receives some message and it sends some message and it does this calculation for each of the bits. Okay? It's not very hard. And then there's also a rule where a bit receives messages and it must send a message back. Well, this message would just be the product of those two. Okay? So the outgoing. Okay, that's roughly the idea. And you can check that if the Tanner graph is a tree, this is exact. Okay, this algorithm at the end, the message that you receive is equal exactly to the marginal probability.
At the end, you mean after many.
Well, I mean, so here it would be the depth of this tree.
I don't understand. So why do these nodes not communicate? You feel that they have to communicate with each other, no? So
that they need to communicate with each other.
To find where the errors are.
Well, I mean, it's look, let me try to give an intuition instead of giving some math. Like, you know, let's say that this one says one of them got flipped, okay? And each one says, you know, 10% probability I was responsible, okay? Well, then, let's say it has, you know, this one is going to send a message saying, well, it's going to send the same message to each of its bits, okay? But now this bit, like, let's suppose that this bit was connected also to some guy that had no error. This one will send the probability to all of these bits. It's unlikely that you have an error. So now some bits will resend, maybe it was you, probably not you, and some message will be, yeah, it seems like it's you. Yep, it seems like it's you, right? So then these guys will go back and say, I think I'm bad. And then eventually it will converge. That's the idea. It's very simple. Okay?
You do the iterations.
Yes, yes. Oh, sorry, I did not. So yeah, you go back and forth.
Yeah, okay. Within two steps, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what's going on. Okay.
Not in two steps. You do.
Well, in two steps, you do have effective communication between the checks. That's what Frank is saying, I think.
But not. I mean, since everything is local, it's not between all the.
Indeed,
pieces.
Indeed. So you have to do this kind of until every check touches every other check. Okay.
I don't quite understand do you have arrows on the lines or the. Like that picture means I'm sending an output to a particular bit? Or?
So this guy, the check, does this calculation for using every bit as the output. So it first computes the one for the last bit using all other ones, and then it goes to the second to last and so on. So there are this type of rule is applied k time if the connectivity is k. Similarly down here. There's, yeah?
Actually, I should draw this tensor network as going up and continuing. Instead of sending it back, it should be continuous.
Yeah, you could indeed. Yes, you could sort of unfold. And if this unfolding is a tree, then this method is exact. Okay. However, these things... Huh? No, these things are not trees. But if you just... I mean, if you write like a five-line program to generate a random sparse graph like this... And you use this algorithm, it's unbelievable how good this is. I mean, just, you know, it takes like five lines to generate this and a couple of lines to do this calculation, and it's just extremely good.
And how many runs do you need before it converges?
Heuristic, I mean. So, okay, if you want to program this, you say, like, when the messages stop changing, just stop, right? Like,
but essentially, it's until everyone communicates with everyone, so it's logarithmic.
I mean, people will tell you that this is a constant time decoder. Encoding theory, right? It's constant.
I mean,
so randomly, you don't really have to communicate with everyone. You just have to.
You just have to communicate within the cluster of errors, right?
Yeah, okay.
But David, is it actually M1 times M2? I mean, that seems weird to me, that if you have, that the message it's sending back is always going to be less than the message it's receiving.
So this would be like the probability of an error, and then you do the same for the probability of no error. These products, they don't do to one, so you renormalize.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
I was a bit.
Okay.
The prior also comes in. I left that out. I just want to get the spirit across. Of course, the typical loop size is logarithmic, so this thing works pretty well heuristically. In fact, there now exists a version. So since Arikan invented the polar code, you know, which solved an open problem for 50 years, other codes have been discovered, and you can now modify this construction to get provably capacity achieving code. And the technique that they use to prove this, I mean, it's all StatMech. It's very nice. So something else. Okay, so I want to talk now about problem. With quantum LDPC.
So can I ask you a question actually? So does it buy anything and to work with trits instead of with bits in such kind of systems? Or does it?
I don't know. I mean, in some, I don't know. I mean, you can do it for sure. I don't know how these things scale with the alphabet size. I haven't looked into this. I know that for polar code, there's a paper that shows that you can improve the error exponent if you go to a larger alphabet. But they show that it's flat until you have an alphabet of size 2^16. It's always 1/2 all the way up to 2^16. So going to this branching structure is really like more than just going to a larger alphabet. You could have thought, oh, it's like you glue two bits together, right? And you just have a four-level alphabet. But no, it's something different. Okay, so problem with quantum LDPC codes. This is one important case where things are different. So I'm going to say something very... Let's continue to talk about classical for a little while. So if the global probability of the, so I'll use star here to say the most likely error. Suppose that the most likely error is much, much more likely than any other error. So what I'm saying here is that condition on the syndrome, there's one error that really stands out, and all the other errors are completely suppressed. So this means this is the situation you want to be in. It means you know what you're doing, right? You choose the most likely error, and you're very, very confident of your choice. If this is true, then if you look at these probabilities marginally, they will also be strongly polarized, right? You have a probability over n bit strings, and the probability is almost like a delta function over some bit string. Well, if you look marginally, it will be a delta function on each bit, right? So probability of EI star will be much greater than probability of EI for all E not equal to E star. So does that make sense? So all I'm saying is that if there is one global event that stands out, it will stand out locally as well. Okay. Okay. In the quantum setting, this thing this condition is impossible. To realize. I will explain this. So it's important that here the decoders for LDPC were marginal decoder. We were not trying to guess what's the global probability and then picking the best thing. We were looking at what's the probability that each bit got an error, and we're picking optimally from this. We don't have... I told you that for the convolutional code, we know how to compute the global optimum. But, I mean, that's like... I don't know any other example from top of my mind where you can actually compute this global optimal. The tools we have are typically for computing marginal information, and it was the case for the polar code as well, right? So why can't this be the, why can't this happen? Remember, the definition of a quantum code. So you have a code which is equal to the set of all quantum states such that they are plus one eigenstate for all MJ. Okay, they are plus one eigenstate of a bunch of stabilizers. So this is really like this picture here. So you have some now quantum mechanical object. These S will be tensor product of Pauli matrices. And you have to be a plus one eigenstate of these guys. So these are called stabilizer generator. Or check. You could call them checks. And they have low weight. Okay, they act on only a few qubit, and that's very important. Okay. So suppose, take your optimal error. So this is the most likely error that has occurred, given the syndrome, okay? And consider another error. Let's call it E prime, which is equal to E star times one of the generators. Okay, pick anyone. Okay? Well, since SJ has low weight, E prime and E star have roughly the same weight. Okay, you've changed the weight just a little bit because you've multiplied by something of low weight. Have roughly equal weight, which implies that they have roughly the same probability. Okay, I'm assuming here some error model where big errors are less likely than small errors, so the error typically only depends on the weight. So this implies that probability of E prime is roughly equal to the probability of E star. So I start with the optimal error, and I've just produced another error that has roughly the same probability as the optimal. Okay. This other error is exactly, cannot be physically distinguished from the other error. Why? Because if you apply E star or E prime to one of the code state, by definition, they do exactly the same, right? They leave all code states invariant. So I've just shown you two different errors that have roughly the same probabilities. I mean, one of them was the optimal error. The other one was just another error that acts exactly identically on the code space. Therefore, starting from a code state, you cannot distinguish these two processes. And they have roughly the same probability. So this means that if I start computing, the marginal probability, it will be flat. It cannot polarize because there are different errors that kind of have the same probability. So the marginal will be flat. Okay, so this tells you, is that clear, this reasoning? Okay. So this tells you that you cannot decode a sparse quantum code by trying to estimate local probabilities. You need global information. Is that clear?
I don't know. I mean, so it's not exactly flat, right?
It's not exactly flat.
By some constant fraction. So you want that now?
Well, the point is that there are lots of these errors. There are lots of very similar error. And in fact, put it this way. Choose a location on which your optimal error has support. I can get rid of that. I can find another error with the same rate that does not have support. So you can make that probability whatever you want. So it is kind of flat. It's not exactly true. Like if you use this decoder for quantum code, it's okay. But you find that it saturates much earlier than it should. And in fact, if you do this numerically, which I've played a lot with these guys, what you find is that it's not that you do the wrong decoding. The decoder is not even able to find a decoder. So like usually you find a correction and it was the wrong one. If you bring the state back to the code space, but in the wrong state. Here, this kind of decoder cannot even bring you back to the code state. So and that should be an easy problem.
And do the turbo codes have a similar, the quantum turbo codes have a similar problem?
No. But they are less interesting because they don't have sparse generators. So the stabilizers have high weight. And that makes them less interesting because it means that you have to measure these super heavy operators, which we don't know how to do physically, right?
But quantum turbo codes have a different problem, right?
They have different problems, yeah. They have different problems. And surface code certainly has this problem, right? If you know about the surface code and you see these two defects, well, you could say, oh, there were two errors, these two errors, or you could say there were these two errors, right? So if you only look at local information, this guy is equally likely as this one. Of course, you could pick either of them. It doesn't matter. They're equally good. But if you look at marginal, two things can happen. You will do nothing or you will apply all four. And neither of these choices are good. And neither of these choices will eliminate these guys. Okay, so just by symmetry, it's obvious here that a local decoder will fail on the simplest possible example. So that's a big problem. And maybe this is a place where machine learning decoders could be used because we don't have anything to decode, and these are an important family of codes for maybe even for building a quantum computer. Do I have time, or should I stop here?
We have a few minutes left.
A few minutes. Well, what else could? Okay, I'll just tell you a little about some other. Whew,
can you say something about the machine learning stuff?
No. Well, I mean. So, okay, it's been applied to surface codes, but we have 10 decoders for surface code, and they're kind of all near optimal. There's kind of a proof of concept. This was Roger. You generate errors that you know, and you train a machine to guess these errors, right? And then you just apply it. For surface code, we have tons of decoders. LDPC, we don't. Or we have this, you need to beat this, and this is pretty crappy. So.
But you didn't try for us?
No,
or?
I did not try. So I can just say a few other kind of areas of research where, there's a relation between tensor network and error correction. So, another thing that becomes hard in the quantum case is when you start playing with realistic noise. The baby model is you say, as I was telling Wojciech earlier, you apply that the noise is Pauli matrices. So you will kind of apply a bunch of Pauli matrices on your qubits at random, and everything after is deterministic. If you know what Pauli matrix was applied in your numerical simulation, you know what would be the syndrome, and then you just run your decoder, and you correct and you check, did I get the right Pauli matrix, or at least did I get one that's right up to a stabilizer? That's very simple. If you have non-Pauli noise model, like let's say you rotate every qubit a little bit, okay, which is more likely to occur in the lab than just like suddenly having an X rotation. If you just rotate every qubit a little bit, then of course you're in a superposition of all the different syndromes, right? You don't know, there's no unique syndrome. So you have to, in your numerical simulation, you would have to simulate the Born rule on n qubits. So you need to compute, simulate the collapse of the wave function. Then you need to compute this post-measurement states. Then you need to find a correction. And at the end, you need to check if your correction was how good of an overlap does it have with the final state. So all these things are just kind of generic, n-body problem. We don't know how to do any of this. But if you have a code that happens to have a tensor network structure, you can exploit that to make these steps efficient. So this is something we've done for surface code. So the surface code, as you know, is a PEPS. What I mean is that all the code states can be represented by PEPS. And then you apply this non-Pauli noise, but non-Pauli noise does not change the bond dimension. It's just local. So you still have a PEPS. The measurements are local, so you can simulate this. You can compute the probability of the outcomes and so on. So everything keeps you in the PEPS world. So at the end of the day, you need to kind of contract this two-dimensional tensor network, which has complexity that is something like square root of n. And if you had not used the PEPS, you would have square root of n, right? Exponential in n. So this is nice. So it gives you a good heuristic decoder. It's an exact, it's an optimal decoder if you use this complexity, but of course you can use tricks like tensor network renormalization and whatnot to get an efficient approximate decoder that can be applied to any type of noise, so non-Pauli noise, even correlated noise, as long as your correlated noise model happens to be a tensor network. So these are things that we have done. And the last thing I wanted to talk about is, so these are things that we've done over the past decade or so, even more. And now the relation between tensor network and error correction is becoming kind of interesting in the context of a holography. What I would like to know in this context is, it's used in holography with an erasure model, okay? And the erasure is like what kids do in coding theory, because it's extremely simple, right? You take a bit string x, you send it, I'm going to do left multiplication, okay, I'll be consistent. So I have a k bit string, and I have an n by k generator matrix, and this is equal to y, which is an n bit string. So now you're going to delete some bits from y. This is equal to deleting rows from G, right? And if you want to correct the erasure, all you need to do is to say, what's the rank of the matrix once I've deleted some rows? Okay. So this is a rank K matrix. I mean, the rows are all independent. The columns are independent. If you start deleting rows, the column may become linearly dependent. So if you want to decode an erasure channel, all you need to do is compute rank, where G is your generator matrix from which you've deleted some rows. Okay? So this is linear algebra. It's extremely simple. This just shows that error correcting the erasure channel it's just linear algebra, so it's clearly efficient. The challenge is always about decoding other noise model, like the bit flip and so on. I'm just wondering, are there interesting coding theory questions in the context of holography?
So what you said is actually simple, because there's exponentially many possibilities, no? For erasing columns, you have to go to all of them.
No, here's the thing. When a bit is erased, you know it's erased. It's not there. So you know which rows have been deleted. You know what bits are missing. So this is the particularity of the erasure channel, is that from the receiver point of view, there's no randomness. I mean, you know exactly what bits are erased. You want to know, can I invert this thing? Is it full rank, yes or no? If it's full rank, I invert it. If it's not full rank, forget it, I can't. So that's it.
So you have to know indeed which
channel. Yeah, but that's the particularity of the erasure channel. It kind of has no randomness. Okay. Yes, the positions are erased at random, but then you know exactly the error. So it sounds maybe like erasure, that's like the worst thing that can happen. No, it's the best thing. You know it's happened, which is not the case of bit flips. Okay, so that sums up what I wanted to say. So.
Do you know, classically, if people have looked at local constraints that are not linear?
In LDPC, like?
Yeah.
I've never seen that. So. Yeah, it's something you could do.
Because once you draw the analogy to physics, it's a very natural thing to do.
Indeed, yeah. I have no idea if it's been done. You can't do syndrome-based decoding, though.
Yeah, well...
But it's fine, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you can, I mean, okay, so the belief propagation could still work,
yeah.
Right? Because, particularly if there's like projector constraints.
In some sense, it's not worse than having a non-symmetric channel. In some sense.
Yeah, the problem, one problem is that you don't know what the size of code space is.
Indeed. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and you don't know,
And it's NP-hard.
And also, you don't know how to encode. That's a big problem.
Yeah.
Like you're probably thinking of a particular, I mean, if you just do it randomly, then obviously it's going to be very hard.
Yeah, I mean, presumably you would design something.
You have to have some structure.
But indeed, so like about encoding, I mean, these you can view like as a Hamiltonian, so they give you constraint, and you know by construction that this Hamiltonian has an exponential degenerate ground state. And these linear constraint, you know exactly what this ground state is. So there, you know, there's a map that takes you inside this ground space. If it's nonlinear, it's very tough problem. So. Sure. Yeah. Yeah, but maybe if you have structure. Yeah.
Yes. Stabilizer world can also look intermediate such that we can design the decoder classically based on the syndrome measurement and then apply a poly. Could you see some advantage of using the fully quantum decoder? But suppose that you're using this for memory and you have your element model and there's a curve.
Yeah, so I've thought about that. So I was interested for a little while about the complexity of generic decoding. So the only thing I could prove is that this Pauli case is sharp P hard. So it goes from NP to sharp P, and the reason is because even in the Pauli setting, you have equivalent errors, so you need to sum them up. The other thing I thought, well, look, let's suppose that you have a stabilizer code. So this is all Clifford stuff, okay? So it's clearly not hard. But then you throw in non-Clifford noise, such as maybe T gates, right? Maybe that's your noise. So it sounds like all the ingredients are there just to show that it's the kind of BQP complete problem. However, I think it's harder because, yes, you know, simulating the noise process is definitely inside BQP. But then you don't get to choose the syndrome. Okay, like the problem, I hand you a syndrome and I say, what's the decoding? On the quantum computer, you cannot decide to reproduce the syndrome. I mean, you would simulate the noise process and then you would get some syndrome at random, but that would not match my syndrome. So the decoding process has a fixed syndrome. So I don't know. And it seems it's not clear that you can do this with a quantum computer. So the best example, I mean, one of the only example out there, I think, is this PEPS decoder, which applies to non-Pauli noise. And they're provided that the noise is described by I call them PEPSO, so it's like a PEP super operator. So any super operator that you can represent as a 2T tensor network, this is efficient. But yeah, I don't know about using a quantum. Lunch?